Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
On this episode of ID the Future, we feature a short interview with Michael Behe about his new book, The Edge of Evolution, The Search for the Limits of Darwinism, published by Free Press, a division of Simon & Schuster. The book is now available in bookstores and online. And for information, you can go to Evolution News and Views at evolutionnews.org. Right now, let's listen in to the interview with Dr. Behe. Darwin's Black Box, you explored the limits of Darwinian evolution to build a complex component within a cell, such as the bacterial flagellum. And you found that such complex machines were, in fact, irreducibly so. That discovery led you to infer that some sort of intelligence had to be involved. The debate over irreducible complexity and your inference to intelligent design is still going 10 years later. So I guess I'm wondering, do you envision your new book, The Edge of Evolution, will have the same sort of impact? And in Edge of Evolution, it seems you're attempting to explain what Darwinian evolution can do and what it can't. Is that going to have the same sort of effect as your ideas about irreducible complexity had, do you think, in the next 10 years?
Well, I'm hoping that The Edge of Evolution will have a bigger impact than Darwin's Black Box. Darwin's Black Box just showed that some things in life are designed, or that's a good explanation for them. In the new book, I ask, how far into life does the design extend? Or the flip side is, how much can random processes like Darwinian processes explain? And the book brings out observational evidence from scientific results from the past 10 years showing that, as many suspected, Darwinian processes don't do much of anything. They make very small changes in pre-existing systems. And so the conclusion is that design is required to get almost all of the complexity of life.
Okay, so you're talking about Darwinian processes, and you're saying that it sounds like you're finding they don't do much of anything, but they must do something. So I'm wondering, did you find instances where Darwinian evolution was more efficient or capable than you had expected it might be?
Darwinian evolution is very efficient. It's the perfect thing when to get a beneficial change, you can break something. So, for example, if you wanted to stop your neighbors from coming into your front door and they had a key to your front door, you could break the lock and they couldn't use their key anymore. And actually, Darwinian immunity to some parasitic diseases is like that. As a matter of fact, resistance to HIV, the virus causes AIDS, it's like that. So Darwinism is a perfect explanation when you have to break machinery, biological machinery, but not when you have to make it.
So when you're talking about these random mutations, which I think that are what we mean often when we refer to Darwinian processes,
yes.
Are they more likely then to be negative and destructive rather than positive? Are they ever positive?
Well, it depends on what one means about something that is positive. Something can be destructive and positive. For example, again, if a burglar is trying to get into your house and you break the lock and he had a key to that lock, he can't get into your house. But that doesn't explain how your lock got there in the first place. But nonetheless, it does protect you. A lot of Darwinian resistance to insecticides, to antibiotics, and so on, is the result of destructive processes, breaking sophisticated machinery, but in some circumstances that helps.
In Edge of Evolution, you make a claim that seems rather controversial in that random mutations, Darwinists refer to as the mechanisms for, you know, building these complex parts of life, are not random at all. Is that what you're trying to say, is they're not really random?
Well, I say in The Edge of Evolution that the mutations, the changes that did build sophisticated systems in life must have been non-random, that is, guided or set up or intelligently arranged somehow. because random changes are known not to be able to do such things. Our best evidence, I go through in the book, from detailed genetic studies of parasitic diseases of humans and others, show that they can't do the job.
Interesting. I change track just a little bit, because in the book that you talk some about nanotechnology, and you've obviously talked about that in the past, and that people generally have an idea, it's almost like a sci-fi idea of what nanotechnology is and something out in the future. But in reality, we really already have nanotechnology. So I was wondering if you could explain that for us a little bit.
Nanotechnology just means machinery that is invisible to the eye because it's so small. And such nanotechnology is old hat to biologists, because in the past 30 years, we've discovered that cells are run by machines, and the machines are made out of molecules called proteins that are so small you can't see them. And they're extremely sophisticated, you know, far beyond anything that Star Trek would have proposed on one of their programs. So just as we know that nanotechnology that we're trying to build from scratch is designed, one can be pretty sure that the nanotechnology of the cell is designed as well.
Now, a lot of people have talked about wanting to abandon any theory of evolution altogether. There are certainly people that don't think it should be taught, and I understand that you disagree with that. And I was just wondering, you know, if you could explain why you think it's a good idea that we have a theory of evolution, and to what extent, when you're examining the edge of evolution, for you, how, you know, you're determining how far that goes in the book. So obviously you don't want to abandon anything altogether. How do we know where we're going to be able to draw those lines? Is that something your book will help with, that point us in the direction of that, or do you already draw the line in the book?
Well, I do draw a line in the book. I say that our best evidence from our most detailed studies on organisms that have the astronomical populations in this world, the malarial parasite, the HIV virus, and so on, demonstrate that random processes simply can't do much more than put scratches or dents in pre-existing cellular machinery. Sometimes that's helpful, so Darwinian processes can do some things, but they simply cannot, and they are demonstrated that they can't explain the complexity that has been discovered in life.
How do you respond when Darwinists claim you're not doing science?
When Darwinists say I'm not doing science, I point to the articles that contain the experiments that I'm talking about. I use the same source of reasoning that they do. So I try to demonstrate that they're wrong. Now, some Darwinists simply say that anything that is pointing towards intelligent design by definition is not science, and there I disagree with them. I think that science is a search for the best explanation about the world using physical evidence and reasonable logic, and in my experience they try to kind of artificially box off a certain conclusion. I want to follow the evidence where it leads. They want to stay on philosophically safe ground.
In The Edge of Evolution, with the book coming out, do you want to make a prediction of how it might be received?
I think a lot of scientists won't like the argument, won't like the conclusion, but I think they will be scrambling to try to explain the data that the book cites. The Edge of Evolution is not like Darwin's Black Box. It's not an argument that Darwinian processes can't explain some machinery in the cell. It is observational evidence to show that in the best cases, when it has the most opportunity, Darwinian processes have been demonstrated not to be able to make sophisticated molecular machinery, have been demonstrated not to do anything other than make little tweaks in the shapes or properties of molecules they already have. So people cannot like that, but it's not like an argument. It's data, and you have to deal with the data.
Very interesting. You seem to enjoy this debate. I mean, you
been through a lot in 10 years since Darwin's Black Box came out. A lot of controversy and debate about that. And yet, another book on a controversial subject. Do you enjoy the debate?
Well, believe it or not, I'm kind of a shy fellow, so I can't say I actually enjoy debate. I do enjoy being able to make really rather pretty simple arguments that fit the data very well and have a lot of, you know, otherwise very intelligent people flustered. So that's kind of fun. And I got into science because I wanted to know how the world worked. And I'm not going to be deterred from that simply because some people don't like where the evidence is pointing.
For more information on the edge of evolution, visit Evolution News and Views at evolutionnews.org. The Edge of Evolution, The Search for the Limits of Darwinism by Michael Behe, is published by Free Press and is available in bookstores and online right now. This is Robert Crowther for IDTF at the CSC in Seattle. Thanks for listening.
Music on ID the Future comes courtesy of composer Yuri Mamchur. Visit www.yuriproductions.com and check out his latest CD, In the Harbor. This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. Discovery president is Bruce Chapman. ID the Future managing editor is Robert Crowther. And the producer is Keith Finn. ID the Future and ID Science in the News is copyright Discovery Institute 2006. For more information, visit www.discovery.org or www.idthefuture.com.